Well, I guess it's one of the most quoted biblical phrases in connection with Christmas, and yet in 12 years here, I don't think I've yet focused on it in a Christmas Day sermon, and so I'm going to do so this morning. We're going to consider the great statement that we have in John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh. The Word became flesh. And I would like to suggest to you this morning then that we encounter in that tiny phrase three great realities. First of all, a grand being. A grand being. We were at a church a few months ago and there was a slot during the service during which a gentleman came to the front and sang Amazing Grace. And the name of the man meant nothing to us, but as soon as he began to sing, it became very clear that he possessed an extraordinary voice. And so later on, we did what you do these days, and we Googled him. And we were immediately flooded with a wealth of biographical information. We discovered that he was a very distinguished tenor. He was performed in some of the greatest concert halls and with the greatest orchestras in the world. So the Google search cast a whole new light on this figure we had encountered in church. And what we did in relation to that figure we had encountered in church, we need to do in relation to this figure that we encounter here in John 1:14. This figure John refers to as the Word. Except we don't need to use Google in order to do so. We only need to shift our gaze a few inches to the earlier parts of the chapter, because in verses 1 to 3, John has already given us biographical information about this person, the Word. And boy, what we discover there really does cast a whole new light on this figure we encounter in verse 14. We're not talking here about a tenor who travels the world singing songs. This person is way more impressive. This is an impressiveness on a different scale altogether. This one that John calls the Word is clearly a grand being. Let's just reflect for a moment then on the grandness of him that emerges in those opening three verses of the chapter. And I hope you'll forgive me if grammatical details are not really your thing on Christmas morning. But the grandness of this being, it's expressed in three prepositions and one verb. So first of all, the preposition in the beginning was the Word, John says. So in the beginning, this being that he's talking about existed. Now, many of you were around in the beginning of English football's Premier League. Some of you were around in the beginning of the National Health Service. Some of you were around in the beginning of the Second World War. To be around in the beginning of something is not in itself, of course, that big a deal. But this is a big deal for one simple reason. John isn't talking here about the beginning of something specific, like the Premier League or the National Health Service. He's talking about just the beginning. The beginning in an absolute sense, the beginning of everything. And he's saying the Word, this person, this figure, he was around then. And it isn't that he was around from the beginning. That's not the preposition that John uses. I mean, that would be fairly impressive in itself, wouldn't it? That would indicate a figure of phenomenal antiquity. But no, it's in the beginning he was around. Suggesting then that he preceded the beginning of everything that is begun. And if he preceded the beginning of everything that is begun, that means that he himself must be unbegun. That is, we're not just talking here about a being of phenomenal antiquity. We're talking here about an eternal being. Mind-blowing stuff. And then the second preposition, with. The Word was with God, John says. So Meghan Markle is apparently spending a Christmas day with the royal family in Sandringham. And judging by the prominence of that piece of information in the news, the idea has excited the popular imagination. Spending Christmas in the very presence of the Queen at the same dining table. around the same log fire, enjoying the same conversations and activities. What a thing. And John is saying, this being, he existed not with the royal family, not with the queen. He existed with God, in his very presence. And actually the preposition in the Greek that John uses is the preposition toward. The word was toward God, and we shouldn't perhaps press that too far, because that can just be another way of saying he was with God. But John may intend at least a suggestion of a particularly intense kind of withness here. I mean, queuing at the till at Marks and Spencer's for half an hour over the past week, you, I suppose, technically were with the person that was standing in front of you, that person who's the back of whose head you became very familiar with during that time. But of course, there was no interaction because you were behind that person. The word, on the other hand, was toward God, John says. Almost as though the two of them, the word and God, were gazing into each other's eyes like two lovers across a restaurant table. And the waiters might be dropping crockery and cutlery all around the place. And there might be a noisy squabble between two fellow diners at another table. And there might be lively musical entertainment going on, but they don't notice because they're so absorbed by each other. And that seems to be the picture here. The word was toward God. So in, where, the third preposition, through. All things were made through him. This being was integral to the universe coming into existence, John is saying. The entirety of the universe, indeed, all things, John says. So you have children, and midway through December, the Christmas tree goes up in your living room and the children all take part in decorating it. And so throughout the Christmas period, subsequently, whenever they look at the Christmas tree, their eyes gravitate to a particular bauble or a particular snowman or a particular angel or even the star on the top, and they say, I put that there. And here's this being that John is talking about. And he looks at the oceans on planet Earth and he says, I put that there. And he looks at the Milky Way galaxy and he says, I put that there. And he looks at the human digestive system and he says, I put that there. And he looks at the whole thing and he says, I put all of it there. And the same logic applies here again as a moment ago. I said that if he preceded the beginning of everything that's begun, then he must be unbegun. And in a similar way, if he made everything that is made, he himself must be unmade. Otherwise, he would have made himself, which is nonsensical. He must be unmade, uncreated, unoriginated. All things were made through him. So three prepositions and then the verb. The verb was. The word was God. And I suppose we only appreciate how remarkable that is if we're a little bit familiar with the gist of the Bible so far up until this point. And the Old Testament scriptures whose message is constantly, this is not God and that is not God. I mean, John here at the beginning of this chapter is very clearly alluding to Genesis chapter 1, isn't he? In the beginning. That's how Genesis chapter 1 starts. And I mean, Genesis chapter 1 is a prime example of this. What is one of Moses' main aims as he writes that passage? It's to say, this is not God and that is not God. The sun is not God, it's just the greater light in the sky. The moon is not God, it's just the lesser light in the sky. The stars are not God, they're just a little throwaway detail in the middle of the whole creation accounts. And now we come to this being in John chapter 1, and suddenly there's this radical change of tone. He is God. The Word is God. Now, of course, this is not, in fact, a departure from the Old Testament's position. John isn't undermining the fierce monotheism of the Old Testament scriptures, John believes that there's one God just as passionately as Moses believes there's only one God. But John understands that the one God is a trinity, the one God is three persons, and he's saying then that this being, the Word, is one of those three persons. He's not an additional God to the God of the Old Testament. He is that God. He is the one and only God that there is, just as the Father is the one and only God that there is, and the Spirit is the one and only God that there is. The Word was God. And so I hope you sense then, through these different expressions, something of the grandness of this being that John is describing. This is unsurpassable grandness. This is incomprehensible grandness. This is inexpressible grandness. I mean, this figure that John is talking about in verse 14, we just don't have enough superlatives for him. Our vocabulary fails us. What language shall we borrow to capture this being? We're talking here about a grand being. A grand being, secondly, notice in our text, a frail nature. A frail nature. So we've talked about the Word. We now need to move to another term that we meet in this phrase, the term flesh. Flesh. What does that mean? Well, often in the New Testament, the word has a meaning quite different to its obvious literal meaning. Often in the New Testament, the flesh is this kind of moral impulse within human beings, the moral impulse to resist and to disobey God. And especially in the writings of Paul, that's what flesh means. But that's not what flesh means here. Because the New Testament also uses this term flesh in a way that resembles much more closely how people would normally use the term today, what we might call the literal sense of the term. However, even when the New Testament does use the term flesh in that more literal sense, there are still different shades of meaning that it can have. So flesh can refer to the stuff our bodies are made of, the tissue between our skin and our bones. It can have that most literal sense. Then again, flesh can refer to the body as a whole. So not just tissue, but the entire physical dimension of our existence, especially when we have the weakness of human bodies being pointed out. Often with this word flesh used of the human body, it's pointing to weakness and frailty. And then again, the word flesh, it can refer to humanity, human nature in a general sense. All flesh, we saw in our text yesterday morning in John's Gospel. And here then, probably that latter sense of the word is most prominent. Flesh here just equals human nature. So not merely bodily existence, not merely tissue, but human nature. So the word became flesh is really tantamount to the word became man. The word became human. But in the light of John's habit of impregnating words with lots of different layers of meaning, we should probably also incorporate that other nuance I mentioned just now, and we should say that flesh here equals human nature, yes, but human nature viewed as something weak and frail. I mean, you think of other words that the Bible is inclined to put with this word flesh. The verb fail. My flesh and my heart may fail, Psalm 73:26. The adjective weak, the flesh is weak, Jesus says in Mark 14:38. The adjective mortal, our mortal flesh, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:11. The noun wind, God remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and comes not again, Psalm 78:39. The noun grass, all flesh is grass, and all its beauty like the flower of the field, Isaiah 40:6. So you think of the way that flesh is the focus of a couple of rather unfavorable contrasts within the New Testament. Matthew 16:17, flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, Simon, but my Father who is in heaven. Ephesians 6:12, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic powers, and so on. It's as if Paul is saying there, if we did only wrestle against flesh, it would be a doddle, but we don't. So I'm saying John then is referring here to human nature. The Word became human, but he's doing so using a term that portrays human nature in its weakness, in its creaturely limitation, in its constitutional frailty. And he's saying then that in an extraordinary turn of events, this grand being, the Word, he came to participate in this frail nature. The one who preceded the beginning, the one who gazed into the very face of God, the one to whom every inch of this cosmos owes its existence, the one who is himself the living and true God, he came to participate in this wind-like, grass-like, mortal flesh. Going back to Meghan Markle spending Christmas with the royal family, I suppose part of the reason that intrigues people is because the whole idea of the royal family's Christmas celebrations is a little bit unimaginable. We see the Queen amidst pomp and ceremony on great state occasions. We struggle to imagine her pulling crackers and wearing a party hat and playing Trivial Pursuit around the coffee table and that kind of thing. But if the Queen participating in Christmas festivities stretches our imagination, what about this that John is talking about? The Word, this grand being, the Word, participating in human nature. A grand being, a frail nature. And then the third thing, a serious participation. A serious participation. Because notice then, it's a very striking verb that John uses, isn't it? The Word became flesh. Not the Word took flesh. Not the Word assumed flesh. That kind of language is appropriate. Paul says, doesn't he, that the one who was in the form of God took the form of a servant. So that's appropriate language. But John here goes for something bolder. He says the Word became flesh. Now, that doesn't mean that some kind of exchange occurred. Some of you will get gifts today and they'll be accompanied by a gift receipt, meaning, of course, that if you don't like the thing, you can go and exchange it. And in doing so, you'll be relinquishing the gift that you were given, and in its place, you'll be acquiring something different. Well, John isn't saying then that by becoming flesh, the Word relinquished what he was before. He relinquished his deity. He relinquished his divine nature that we've said he had. No. He wasn't exchanging his deity for humanity. That can't be the case. Because John will later present the Word, having become flesh, saying things like this: I and the Father are one. I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. All that belongs to the Father is mine. Anyone who has seen the Father has seen me. And not only saying things like that, but receiving the worship of a formerly blind man whom he has healed. And on one occasion, even being addressed by an awestruck disciple in these terms: my Lord and my God. So clearly, he is still at all points the grand being that he has always been. So we mustn't overinterpret this verb as though John is saying an exchange took place, but we must do justice to this verb and infer from it that it's a serious participation in flesh, in weak human nature, that John is talking about. What might that mean? Well, for one thing, it means reality. Reality. I mean, Satan in the Garden of Eden appeared as a serpent. He didn't become a serpent. The Word, however, really became human. It wasn't an appearance. It wasn't a form. A few years ago, Simon Calvert from the Christian Institute was speaking at some event in Parliament alongside the actor and comedian Rowan Atkinson. And we watched a clip of this. And Isaac was quite young at the time and he saw this. And he said, "What is Mr. Calvert doing with Mr. Bean?" But of course, Rowan Atkinson isn't Mr. Bean, it's just a persona that he adopts in certain contexts. Well, human nature was not a persona which the Word adopted. As one writer puts it, to have become flesh is to be flesh. A salutary reminder that humanness isn't simply attached to him like a mask or a garment or an artificial limb. It is something which he is. So it certainly means reality. Then for another thing, it means completeness. The Word didn't take a pick and mix approach, participating in some aspects of humanness, but not others. No, he became flesh. He became it. In other words, whatever it means to be human, the Word participated in it all. Whatever it means to be human physically, whatever it means to be human intellectually, whatever it means to be human emotionally, whatever it means to be human socially, whatever it means to be human environmentally, living within the confines of space and time on planet Earth, whatever it means to be human religiously, having a prayerful, dependent relationship with the God of heaven, he participated in it all. To be human is to develop and mature over time. He developed and matured over time. To be human is to need food and drink and sleep. He needed food and drink and sleep. To be human is to be tempted morally. He was tempted morally. I'm saying there were no gaps in this human existence into which the Word entered. It was a complete package. The Word became flesh. So it means reality. It means completeness. And then what other thing it means? Permanence. Permanence. The Word didn't participate in human nature for a season. No, once he'd embraced it, it would be his forevermore. That's why John says in another place in his first letter in chapter 4, verse 2, he has come in the flesh. Not he came in the flesh. Notice the tense, he has come in the flesh. John Stott says the perfect tense seems to emphasize that the flesh assumed has become his permanent possession. On Friday evening, perhaps some of you came home from work and kind of ripped off your work clothes with glee. I don't need those now for a good few days. At no point has the Word ripped off his human nature. I don't need that anymore. He couldn't even if he wanted to, and thank God he doesn't want to. But he couldn't. He could no more rip off his human nature now than he could rip off his divine nature now. He became flesh. So those are the three great realities then that we have in our text this morning. A grand being, a frail nature, a serious participation. What should we do with all this? Well, just three words as we close. First word, worship. Worship. I mean, it will be said in many churches today, perhaps something like this. You know, God has given us this wonderful Christmas present, Jesus. Will you receive that present, that gift? And that's a valid message and an appropriate way of presenting the gospel. But it's not the only way the gospel is presented to us in the New Testament. And at the risk of offending some of you, let me just be a little bit more confrontational this morning and say this. There is this awesomely grand being called the Word, to whom you owe worship, to whom there's no other appropriate response than to fall on your face in front of him. Have you done that? Are you doing that? I'm saying the Bible's message isn't just, or in fact isn't primarily, here's a lifestyle choice of being a Christian that you might really like. No, the Bible's message is primarily, here's a reality that you can't alter or evade any more than you can alter or evade the law of gravity. The existence of this grand being. Recognize this reality and respond accordingly. Worship this being, the Word, of whom John speaks. Worship, a second word this morning, wonder. Wonder. Some of you are absorbed by the mysteries of astrophysics. Some of you are absorbed by the twists and turns of history. Some of you are absorbed by the complexities of neuroscience. Some of you are absorbed by the transportive power of literature. And so we could go on. And these are great things to be absorbed by. We live in a world that is full of wonders, don't we? And it's a good thing to explore those to their limits. But be absorbed by this, the supreme wonder. And devote your greatest energies indeed to wrapping your mind around this, the greatest wonder the world has ever seen. The Word becoming flesh, this grand being participating in this frail nature. I mean, it's phenomenal when you think about it. The person in that manger, he's one person. There aren't several babies lying there. There's one person there. And yet that person is simultaneously eternal and mortal, creator and creature, God and man. He's simultaneously the maker of the stars and this one who is lying there on his back, dwarfed by the stars in the Bethlehem sky. He's simultaneously Mary's Lord and Mary's firstborn infant child. I mean, the paradoxes involved here are just endless, aren't they? And sublime. And I'm saying explore them. Explore all the wonders of this world, but explore with the greatest energy, the greatest wonder of all, that the Word participated in human nature. Worship, wonder, and then a final word, wisdom. Wisdom. Some of you will remember the comedian, I assume he's still around doing something, a Dom Jolly, and was it 15 years ago or so, he used to do that thing, Trigger Happy TV, where he would go around doing crazy antics in the public and would film people's reactions to them. And I remember that one of these was that he would dress up as a burglar, I mean a real kind of caricatured burglar with a kind of a stripy top and a big sack over his shoulder saying swag on it. And he would kind of wander around the village, just getting into casual, ordinary conversations with people. And certainly on the ones that were filmed and made it into the final cut, so often then you would have some person in the garden just having a perfectly ordinary conversation about the weather or politics with this guy who was dressed up like a burglar. I suppose it's a very British thing to do, perhaps, just to carry on as though everything's normal. And no one seemed to think to ask them, what is this guy doing dressed up like this? Why is he doing it? And perhaps we can be a bit like that when it comes to what we've been talking about this morning. And we can even say, well, yeah, this is staggering. This is a great wonder that this grand being, he participated in such a frail nature. It is a great wonder. And then we just kind of move on. And we never think to ask, why is he doing it? Why on earth is he doing it? What use can such a frail nature possibly be to such a grand being? It cannot be of any use, surely. He has everything. He possesses the cosmos, the entire universe. He possesses the intimacy of God. He possesses the very being and nature of God within himself. What use can he have? He can't have any use, surely, for a frail human nature. And that's true, there's no use he could have for a frail human nature except for one. The only use he could possibly have for a frail human nature is if this grand being loves frail human beings. Frail human beings who are sinners and are liable to the punishment and wrath of Almighty God. And if loving them so much, he actually wants to come and wants to take their place and wants to hang on a cross and bear the punishment that they deserve in their stead. That's the only use a frail human nature could possibly have to this grand being. And I'm saying wisdom then asks the question, what's this about? Why is he doing this? Wisdom doesn't suffice to sing a few cows and say, this is amazing, and then move on. Wisdom says, why was he doing this? And wisdom, having discovered the only possible explanation, that he was taking frail human nature in order to die on a cross as a sacrifice for sinners, wisdom then says, I'm going to take my sins to him. And he's going to be the sacrifice for my sins. And I'm going to be saved. And I'm going to be rescued. And I'm going to be reconciled to God through this person. So this morning, in light of everything we said, everything John is saying here, make sure you're worshipping this person. Explore the wonder of it all, the rest of your life. And make sure you ask the question wisely, why it's happening. And respond by bringing your sins to this sacrifice for sinners. Amen.